painting to photography, from beadwork to woodworking. KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University presents Artbeat. Artbeat highlights the work and accomplishments of local artists from in and around Winona. Support for Artbeat is made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
Hi, this is Brianna Klaprick. On today's show, we have a sculptor who specializes in found object work. Recently, he has shown at the Anderson Center, the Fine Artists of Southeast Minnesota exhibition, and also has work at the Lanesboro Art Center. Originally from the East Coast, this artist will share with us the differences between the East Coast and Midwest art scenes. Would you like to go ahead and introduce yourself?
My full name is Arthur Andrew Chulik. I go by Andrew, and I've been an artist pretty much my whole life. It was something that I started out with as a kid, and it was just like one of those natural, intuitive abilities that I had, and I like to create, and I like to make things. And that kind of stayed with me all through my life, although I did a stint into writing, but I eventually wound up going back into the visual arts. That kind of really satisfied my urges to make things and to learn and to express myself. So that carried just on and on and on over, I think I had my first show in 1968. So that gives you a timeline of how long I've been showing and making art. I mean, I've had little interludes in between where I've started businesses. I like business. I did furniture design. You know, I had corporate jobs. You know, we did all the things that a lot of artists do. But I gained a lot of business experience in the process, which makes it kind of unique in the sense that an artist and designer and creator, but I'm also a business person who understands business, as opposed to artists who are suddenly, well, how am I going to sell my artwork? And they don't understand anything about how the gallery system works or how businesses work.
Right.
And here I am today. I'm kind of semi-retired.
How old were you when you had your first show?
I was 20 years old.
What was that like?
It was fun. It happened in Hampshire at Keene State College. And it's a fun story. I had met a girl at the school, and she said, oh, you ought to show your work to my art professor. So I went in with this huge portfolio of drawings. I was very prolific. And he sat there, and he went through everything, and he looked at it, and he's shaking, closes it up, and he says, bring me the same amount next week. So, okay, so I go back, and I did that. And he said, well, we have an opening between shows, and I want to give you a show of the work. And at the time, I was doing these monoprints using paint rollers and paint dyes and with rabbit skin glue on paper. And so they were somewhat, you know, mostly abstract pieces. But I had no way of presenting them because they were large, like 20 by 26. So another friend said, well, you ought to go see this particular woman, Beatrix Sagendorf. She was the owner of Yankee Magazine. And so I went there and showed her my work. And she held no judgment on it. And she said, well, what can I do to help? And I said, well, I need $20 to buy mat board. So she writes me this check for $20. And then, you know, my friend cashes it for me. And then we go buy mat board. And he helps me mat the pieces. And that was how the first show started.
Wonderful. So you're originally from?
Originally from Massachusetts, born in Salem, Massachusetts.
And what brought you to the Midwest as opposed to staying to the East Coast?
My brother-in-law, Bob Reagan, is a physics professor, tenured physics professor at UWL. His kids are, you know, well ensconced into the school system, and we decided to move. It was getting expensive where we were living in New Hampshire at the time, because we were living in Portsmouth, which is a seacoast town, and it was beautiful. We miss it. You know, the ocean was always right there, and you know, you'd get up in the morning, you'd smell the ocean. So we kind of missed that, but that was what brought us, you know, out here.
What do you think was a defining moment in your life as an artist? Like, was there a moment that you realized that this was going to be something you did for the rest of your life?
I think it was just something that I just always did. It was always just part of me. So it wasn't any one, you know, kind of epiphany of like, oh, okay. This is what I'm going to be. It was something like, you know, I started doing it when I was 8 and 9 years old and winning little poster contests in school. And Mad Magazine was a great resource for me as a kid growing up, because then I learned really how to draw from that magazine, you know. But I didn't go to art school.
Did you go to school or college?
I went to UNH in New Hampshire, University of New Hampshire, and Keene State College a little bit. So,
what's your creative process like? How do you start to make something, or what kind of things inspire you?
It just starts with thinking. You know, you look at something, and it could be anything, and that just stimulates a thought, and you start to think about it. And, you know, for instance, if I have, like, really nothing to do, I can invent something to do. I'll go into the studio and I'll pick something up and I'll start playing with it, or I'll say, well, maybe I'll draw, and then that starts a whole avenue of exploration. So it's easy to pick up on little threads. I mean, there isn't like a light bulb that comes on and you go like, oh, I gotta go do this. It's this kind of seepage. Creative okay. Seepage is kind of really what it's like, and it just keeps coming out that way.
Do you think that plays a part in the mediums you use, like kind of found objects? Do you think your process of working kind of influences that?
Yeah, I like found objects because it's much more intuitive. Earlier work that I was doing before that was very geometric metal work, folded aluminum. I have a couple of those pieces. I had shown those and sold some of those in New York. One of the directors of the Walker Art Center in Minneapolis had bought one of the pieces over the years, and as I was leaving the East Coast, he was moving back to the East Coast, and which was unfortunate, but he had collected a few of my pieces that way. And so that was very polished metal, very hard edge, very precise, and I think that's how I got doing the boxes, because those are very precise things, and I need to balance the desire to do things that are very precise against things that can be, although this something like this is still very precise, there's a certain roughness to it that I don't have to really, you know, it doesn't have to be immaculate. You know, it can have a little spot or a little thing or whatever, and that becomes part of what it's about. I don't want it to be too perfect.
Can you explain a little bit about your box work? How did that start?
I had designed and made art furniture, art studio furniture, flat files, cabinets, and that kind of things. And over the years, I think when I finally closed my last business because of economic times, I was making desks and, you know, big heavy things. And I had vowed when I started out that if I couldn't pick it up and carry it myself, I wasn't going to make it. And at that point, then I had 4 or 5 people working for me, 2 floors in a building. And so I took a rest and was visiting in Portsmouth at the time, and went into a gallery and was talking with this woman there. And she said, you know, there's really a need for some really interesting boxes. You know, at the time, there really wasn't. There was all kinds of little cute things with, you know, doodads and things all over them. But she said, you know, something that's a little more serious and elegant. So I came up with some designs that, when I look back at them now, you know, I really laugh at how rough they were. But at the time, there wasn't anything like that out there. And I, you know, I even took them to New York. I had a bag, and I stayed with some friends down in Soho and walked around door to door, you know, like till I found some galleries that would take the work. And then over time, it just kept evolving and evolving, so that finally, until about, I think, in 97, I did my first American Craft Council show. A friend of mine she had been doing the shows for years, and if you could sponsor somebody, so I would get a free booth. So I developed a lot of work, and from there, it just, you know, slowly, you know, took off. I did it all the time. It was like almost like 24/7. It's like I had a 5,000 square foot studio that was divided down the middle. One half was for the production of boxes. The other half was for my sculpture, which looked like this huge junkyard. And then I had a living space, like a small apartment. And so I just lived there and worked there day and night. And I could barely keep up. That was the joy of it. And yet we all knew it wasn't going to last.
And what are you moving towards now? Are you kind of moving away from the boxes?
Probably in another year or so, I'm not even going to bother with it unless, you know, I just don't see the economy coming back for a long time. And by then, I'm just not going to have the energy to do that. Because it's a lot of energy. There was a time where you could do all these big shows and do little retail shows, and that's great when you're young. But when you get older, it's just it's expensive to do, very expensive, more than people realize. So many galleries are gone now that the markets have really, really shrunk. So you have more and more people trying to sell in these little tiny markets. Mm-hmm. So now I'm just kind of doing what I just feel like doing. You know, I enjoy exploring different themes with the sculptures. You know, having a place to show, like the Anderson Center in Red Wing, is great, knowing that I can always count on two exhibit periods, you know, a year, as long as this guy is director. So it's my little home. So that keeps me producing the work. Mm-hmm. The downside is that it all comes back here. So, you know, after a few more of those shows, I mean, I'm going to have to start really storing stuff away in boxes and, you know, rotating things out if I want to see them. But, you know, normally they come back and, you know, they came back from the summer and this is where the stuff has been sitting. And then, you know, exploring like the Cocoon Chrysalis series is something that I started back in the early or the mid 70s. And I did a few of them and then stopped doing them. And I thought going back to it might be a fun thing because it's a little more traditional in its the way that it's done. You know, you're building a form with an armature and then you're building that out with sculpture wire and mesh and then foaming it and carving it down and then using plaster over that and shaping and sanding and carving and doing that. So I like the idea of just creating the form, you know, from scratch. Found object work is harder because you have to find those special relationships.
Are there any other found object artists that you can identify with?
Well, I mean, there's always the classic artist. The one that I liked the most, that I was most influenced by, was Rauschenberg, because he was like really the first to push that stuff out there, you know, of that school. There was a certain dedication to the idea and not so much worrying about the preservation of the materials. A lot of those things, you know, deteriorated. Let's say Edward Kleinholz, same kind of thing, with his Barney's Beanery and all these kind of figures that were heavily shellacked and, you know, these bizarre kinds of settings. And again, that's, you know, also throwbacks to the 60s when there was really great art being made. There isn't great art being made today, unfortunately. But
what makes you say that?
Because I see
just experience, or
yeah, if I go through like an art magazine, mm-hmm. and I'm just flipping, a page will stop me. I'll say, "Wow, that's really a nice piece." I'll either know who the artist is, or I'll look at the date, and it'll be like, you know, in the 60s or early 70s type of work. And that was when it was just, I forget which artist said it, but it said art was more like a religion in that sense, that, you know, you really adhered to certain the rules and laws of what was within that world. And once the pop stuff came in, I mean, that's great stuff too. But it wasn't until like mid-90s, late 90s, that I felt it was, artwork was becoming very commercial. I mean, again, it was a money period. A lot of people had a lot of money. And they, the sense of value of artwork, you know, what people were paying $50,000 for someone who wasn't very well known but promoted by a gallery, it's an investment, they're going to keep doing it. it became like American Idol. You know, it became very crass, commercialized. Galleries, in order to find fresher and newer work, were just like scouring the art schools, coast to coast, taking students' work, right after they graduated and giving them shows. And you were a one-shot wonder. You got out there and maybe you did okay, maybe you didn't, and then your career was over. So people were just pumping the stuff out. And like a lot of the installation art that you tend to see, it's very intriguing, but it's I'd love to do it if I had some huge factory space to do it in, but mm-hmm. then what do you do with it afterwards? It's always that afterwards. Paintings, if you're doing big paintings, what are you going to do with them? So anyway, the whole star system, like Julian Schnabel really kicked that one off with his pottery shard dinner plate paintings, and you could do anything, and people were buying it. And what was interesting is, like, when there was this I think it was Hurricane Andrew went through Florida. At that time, I was working for a fine art transportation company in Boston, and we had an office down in Orlando. And so what happened was that so many of these expensive homes got wiped out, and along with the homes went all this art that people had spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on, for which they could get no insurance value for, because there was nothing to corroborate that the work had any value other than what they could say, well, this is what I paid for it, where's the artist now, what's happening? And that was a real eye-opener in terms of how artwork became valued and as an investment. So now you tend to see a lot of galleries selling much older work, from the 40s, 50s, and 60s, in the way of mostly, editions of prints and that kind of thing, which is why those artists did them. And so it was a commodity, in that sense. Commodity overtook the market.
Do you think that makes it hard for artists these days?
Sure.
Producing work?
You got to be... You really have to be in the right place at the right time, and it's very competitive. There was a period, I remember, hanging out in New York in the early 70s and late 60s, and there was a great camaraderie of artists. There was the, quote, Spring Street Bar and all this stuff, and artists, would get together, and you'd have heated discussions about art, and you shared ideas. And then by the 80s, everyone became very closed and paranoid that people were ripping off their ideas, and so this competitiveness came into play, and then eventually it just became what it became.
So how do you think the artistic climate of now is affecting your work?
Well, I mean, I'm doing my work for me. I wrestle with the idea of, like, well, why not go out and really try to make a connection? And one of the things with that a lot of artists don't realize is that once you, let's say you find a gallery that wants to bring you into their stable. I mean, again, the whole gallery concepts and the way they market has changed dramatically, from 20, 30 years ago. You're stuck with what you're doing at that point. I had a friend back in the Boston area, and he was carried by a gallery, Stux, for a long time, and he had lots of shows, and Stux had a gallery in Manhattan. And so his rotation was coming up for another show. So he did this whole series of work that was different from the work that the gallery was selling, and he came in and to install the show, and the gallery owner says, "What's this stuff?" I said, "Well, this is my new work." I said, "Well, I don't, this is not what we're selling." And they got into a big to-do, and he lost the gallery. He was devastated. I mean, they said, "No, get your stuff out of here. If you're not going to do this other stuff that we've been promoting and selling," because they have to take and say, "Well, there's some longevity to what you're doing. So if you just are changing all the time and never really reaching any kind of finality of an idea or a trend, then they have nothing to really build on. So they can't say, 'Oh, what do you see his next show with the work that he's doing that's continuing this?'" Right. this particular process. So once you get out there, it's you're really at the whim of the gallery owners, and it's much more cutthroat than the old days.
So I've been asking this question about craft versus creation in art, mm-hmm. and how you feel your work falls on the scale of craft versus creation.
Okay, that's a great question. I'm prepared to answer that. Because I had to work that out. The boxes to me are, I call it high craft. They are designed pieces with the intent of selling. They are about, there's a functionality to them. Not all craft functions other than something visual, but mine can work as sculptures. They can also work as a functional object. But to me, that's craft, and that's how I marketed them. It was through craft. And depending on where you go in the market, if you get into the American Craft Council shows, if you can get, the big shows are in Philadelphia, the Smithsonian show. Those are like the real highest shows that you're going to get into in the country, and they're very hard to get into. But this stuff is my art. And the separation, the way I separate it, is that craft, I'll go through American Craft magazine and I'll look at a lot of stuff, and it's incredibly well made, extraordinarily detailed. Oh my God, I can't believe that's glass. I can't believe it's this, it's that. But it's more about the material and the process than it is about the idea. Because when you take the idea away from the material, you go it's not some kind of goofy thing, but it's made out of glass. And with fine art, it's more about the idea than the materials, although there are crossovers where if you're casting out of bronze or when you really separate the two genres, that's how I separate them. One is more about the idea, less the material. The other is more about the material and the process, and the idea is secondary in terms of what it's saying.
So how long did it take for you to reach the kind of methodology that you have when making a piece? I know you talked about your process, but was it kind of a lifetime of just doing things? Or did you always kind of have a certain way of working?
I think it was just an innate ability to figure things out, combined with some curiosity. But I'm a good problem solver, and I like to research. And I probably would have wound up being some research bug somewhere in some business, but I like that thinking process of researching materials, ideas, and stuff. It's like if I'm going to do something around the house, okay, I'm going to Menards for a research, and I'll spend 2 hours walking around, taking notes, looking at things, okay. Then I come back and I put something together. I just made a piece of furniture. And it's just figuring out. I really get excited about figuring out how something is going to go together. Like how do I put any of these things together so it doesn't show how they're put together? Back in Massachusetts, when I had the big studio, I was doing a lot of bigger, heavier industrial pieces because I had access to a lot of material like that. And so that I had certain criteria, it's like I wanted to be able to use anything. I wanted to use some porcelain coated cast iron with some aluminum and some stainless steel and this and that. I was more interested in the forms and how they were going to interact. So I had to find ways of joining them, because people say, why didn't you weld? And unless you're a really good welder, it's pointless. And for the things that I was doing, you really couldn't weld. You couldn't even braze. So I did all this hidden joinery of drilling and tapping and bolting and fitting things together, and so that with bigger pieces I could build them and then take them apart, move them, reassemble them. So that becomes the real figuring process is how it goes together. It's like even those little goddess pieces that are out there. To be able to pick the whole thing up all in one piece, it's like, how was that all together? And it's just a series of stops and rods and threaded nuts and connectors and it has to all sequence together. And there's only one sequence that it's going to work in to go together.
Have you ever been discouraged as an artist?
Discouraged in the sense that I wish I had been in other places at other times. You know, I wish I had spent more time in New York or stayed in Boston or something like that, where you're closer to the heart of what was going on. I think that I could have achieved more success. So that becomes a lament for me. But not a discouragement, but it's like, but I can, we can all think back to things in our lives that, well, if we had stayed here, if we had done that, I said, oh, gee, why didn't I go and see that person? And, et cetera, et cetera. It's like back in the 60s, I went out to California at it was like 66, height of the hippie thing, and I was living on Sunset Strip. And somebody offered a job at a club that had musicians and comedians. And at the time, I had been in a group, in a rock group. We all were. I realized, no, I'm not a rock musician. I'm not any kind of musician to speak of. So I didn't follow through with it. But if I had just gone in and used that lead in, I said, I'll sweep floors, do whatever, I would have met a whole different array of people and made different connections, and would have changed what I was doing, but I didn't. The wastefulness of youth.
What advice would you give someone who wants to kind of pursue a career like yours, or to do some of the things that you've done?
If you really want to push your career, you've got to go to the big cities. You've got to go and see. So imagine being around that energy, all the time. That's what you need. You need something to be feeding you. If you're in a situation where you're trying to create that energy yourself and thinking that it's going to reciprocate back from others to you, that's not going to work. It has to be something that's much, much bigger than you for you to tap into, and don't aim low, aim high.
Okay.
Yeah.
So do you think the energy of a larger city feeds more into this kind of
area?
Oh,
yeah, absolutely, because there's just much more stimulus, there are more galleries, there are more, particularly big cities have museums. So, in Manhattan, my God, Sunday afternoon at the Met is shoulder to shoulder. I mean, people, families grow up going to these places, and so they educate themselves about art. They're going to the Museum of Contemporary Art. Like we were in Chicago in the spring, and it was just so wonderful. You get museums to pick from, to go to, galleries to pick from, to go to and see work, let alone what you're seeing in terms of design of buildings and architecture and all these kind of very creative aspects of human nature that are around you. And that, you really need that. If you want to be just an isolationist, then you're going to paint what's outside your window.
What do you think, personally, that the artist's role in society is or should be?
Well, I think the artist's role is really to help people see beyond themselves. That art is, the artist can't really take on the role of teacher. For myself, I'll produce work that I want people to somehow find a way into. Like somebody will be like, well, I don't get this. And I'll start to explain it a little bit, and after a while they go, oh yeah, I see what you're doing. So you try to open up their minds a little bit with what you're doing, and sometimes you challenge them, sometimes you overtly challenge them, and to the point that it's almost a hostile act. But if you just show them nice, nice, pretty, provincial artwork, then that's all they think that it is. And that's the problem with this area, is that people are just provincialized into what they think art should be. And any of these little art groups and art organizations only proliferate that. They don't take, I wanted to go out and start to educate the public and put things out there that would start to be stimulating and create discussion and conversation. And if you're not really doing that, if you just walk and say, oh, that was nice, that was pretty, then okay, well, it's a postcard.
Right. Do you think that art can problem solve outside of its medium?
That you're contributing to, you're showing an example of human consciousness and idea and how thought permeates everything. Everything is an idea outside of the natural world. Everything was created by somebody. Somebody thought it up, and you're surrounded by that. And rather than just sit and be, you know, a toad in the middle of the lily pad, I think that the artist can contribute to a community by broadening its view of understanding how things work a little bit. Not that all artists get along. I mean, God, don't put a room full of artists together and expect anything to come out of there. But I think we contribute to the culture of the world. I mean, what is culture? And, you know, it's like saying, well, what does theater contribute? What does music contribute? Mm-hmm. You know, and it stretches your mind.
And here's kind of a last fun question that I like to ask sometimes. If you could show with any artist, like alive or dead, someone that you would just like to have your work seen with or opposing, do you have anyone in mind?
Well, one artist that influenced me a lot and who I got to see his work very close and meet was Frank Stella. And his early work changed the way I thought about art, and his later work I just love. It's very challenging. Him and Alexander Calder would be my two picks right there.
How about your show coming up in Red Wing?
Yep, that's in.
When is that going to be?
That's December 10th. That's a Saturday. And that's combined with, that's a holiday fair show, mm-hmm. too, but in their main gallery. You been to the Anderson Center?
Mm-mm.
Oh, you got to go. Oh, God. They have a great permanent collection downstairs, but they have like a large upstairs gallery where they have rotating shows going through there, and then throughout the building there's artwork all around, and then there are tables and things for other artists who are selling more gift oriented stuff, and for the summer show they have outdoor tents and that sort of thing. But because in the spring, like it was in February, end of February, we had a show up there just about tornadoes, so the whole gallery was just filled with all these different artists. It was all thematic to tornadoes, and that was kind of fun. So so actually I've had three, maybe the third show. But it's also the Anderson Center is a retreat for artists, that and artists come from all over the world and might spend, you know, a week, 2 weeks, a month, you know, in residency there. And there's some writers' workshops, there's a glass blowing studio, there's a pottery studio, there's.
Thank you for letting me interview you.
Yeah, glad to do it.
Thank you again to Andrew Chulik for inviting us into your home and interviewing with us.
Art Beat is written and produced by KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University. Visit us on the web at kqal.org.